is Hour 1 of the Freedom Fiends Weekend Edition, broadcasting from the Warmabago Mobile Studio in the murky depths of Bootleg Bog, where even the plants are carnivorous. And the Freedom Fiends is covered by a BIPOC no government license. This allows reuse by anyone except governments. And you can learn more about that at BIPCOT.org. That's BIPCOT.org. And my name is Ben Stone. Joining me by way of fiend phone, satellite, internet, computer, technology from the future is my friend Randy England. Hey, Randy. Good to have you back on the Freedom Fiends. You've been gone for a while.
Hi, Ben. Hey, I have been. I had a really, really busy month, and it was, fighting the state at every turn. But we're doing pretty good here now. I'm safe. We have no carnivorous plants that I've noticed, at least not in the house here. So I'm really glad to be here on the weekend Freedom Fiends with you, Ben. And it's just the two of us here, although, who knows, maybe Michael will.
You never know.
While we're here today. He pops in and out. You never know.
He's uncontrollable.
Although... Well, it definitely is uncontrolled. Michael's a force. And not in a bad way, but of course. But, well, never mind. I was going to talk more about Michael. He needs to come on. He can tell us how he's doing right now. Before we came on the air, we had to be talking. It seems like, everyone is talking about this thing about the lady, the clerk in Kentucky, who... decided that she can't issue marriage licenses to anyone lest she have to issue marriage licenses to same-sex couples. And, I think there's probably no... I guess everyone accepts the fact that it's a matter of conscience. So that's what she says about herself. But on the other hand, people, rightfully think, well... nobody's forcing you. You could quit, right?
Yeah. And there is a point to that. But on the other hand, you could also say the exact same thing about, say, Private Manning. If he believed the things that he believed, then why did he continue to work there and do those things right up to the point where he was arrested? You could say the same thing about, Snowden. You could say the same thing about anybody who's in the military. Or in any other job, police or, a judge or anything else. And at the same time, well, we always get these people that tell us, well, why don't you try to change the system from inside? And that's an argument. I may not be all that crazy about that argument. And I'm not trying to say that she, for doing what she did in Kentucky, she did something great and dangerous like what Manning did or what Snowden did. But if that's her principles and that's where her mind and her beliefs lie, then in a sense, whether she's right or wrong, she was following her principles the same way Manning or Snowden did, don't you think?
Well, I do. And what you're saying is that it's not just a moral dilemma that she has or that Edward Snowden was faced with a point of he's working in this evil machine that is and the truth of that is becoming more and more apparent to him, and it reaches a point where he says, I can't do this anymore.
Right.
And now I don't know what Bradley Manning did. I know that Manning and Snowden were both whistleblowers. Mm-hmm. And they had I don't know if Snowden was definitely doing things that would violate his conscience at some point. I don't even know if Bradley Manning was doing something that violated his conscience. I don't even know what his job was. But he had information that he thought the public definitely needed to have. I mean, I don't know what all of the things that he ended up revealing, but the one that I think we all know so much about was the murder of the Reuters news team in Iraq,
right,
by American helicopter crews, and how the helicopter guys in the helicopter with the big machine guns were just delighted and happy to pick off this whole news team. And we're just now, they said at the beginning they thought they were terrorists, but that wasn't apparent. They didn't know. And I remember when I watched that video, I kind of was thinking, well, maybe they were honestly mistaken. But then when the family pulls up in the van, you had most of the team was dead. There's one or two guys crawling around on the ground trying to get to cover. And up pulls a van with a family in it. And somebody gets out of the van to come over to this guy who's crawling to try and help them. And they immediately, in the helicopter, they say, more terrorists have arrived. You know, can we kill them all? And then they get the permission over the radio to kill them all. And then they let loose with these rounds that they were firing. What were they, like 20 millimeter
probably,
or something? They were huge. They're like throwing, you know, metal sausages into people, ripping that van apart. And then, you know, they're circling all around and everything. Finally, American soldiers arrive on foot and go in, and you see them, they're going into the van and getting children out of there, carrying them in their arms,
yeah,
you know, off. And you just want to throw up watching it, and you're thinking to yourselves, there wasn't the slightest reason to believe that the van that stopped to help these people were terrorists.
Right.
And of course, there were no terrorists anyway, including the original team that was murdered, plus the ones that were killed in the van that stopped to help. He had that, and as far as I'm concerned, the guy's a total hero for making that public, same as Snowden. But back to the clerk. The idea there is, it wasn't just, I'm doing this because I can't do this anymore. It's not like I'm refusing my duty, but they have a larger purpose. And I think she certainly had a larger purpose, because if she just wanted to get out from under the duty to issue marriage licenses, she could have just said, this job requires me to do something that I can't do anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And so I am... I'm going to leave. I know when I was a prosecutor, I mean, I eventually left that job because I was no longer comfortable doing many of the things that I did.
Yeah.
I was not comfortable with prosecuting victimless crimes. I didn't have to do much of that, you know, in the later years that I did that, because I actually, when you get more experience, you actually are given the luxury of prosecuting actual criminals, people that hurt other people, like murderers and you know, assault people that, you know, brain somebody and they can't even talk again and things like that. And so, you know, those are the kinds of crimes that I had no conscience problems at all about.
Mm-hmm.
Except I don't know, maybe I mean I'm still grateful that I did not prosecute someone and send them to death. That's something that I still, I'm happy that I was not in that. I had a death case at the time I left, which I did not think would end up in a death penalty. And after I left, it turned out that I was right. But I can see that, you know, I was getting less and less comfortable. And finally, I just said, I got to go,
mm-hmm.
you know, for this and some other reasons. I mean, I really did like the idea of getting out and becoming a defense attorney rather than being a prosecutor. But I was being asked to do things that I just didn't feel comfortable anymore doing. And I quit.
Yeah.
And there was nothing heroic about it or anything like that. And I didn't play it to a larger agenda. Maybe, you know, I could have waited until I got my next drug case, and then I could have called a press conference and said, I won't do it.
Mm-hmm.
And a whole bunch of stuff like that, got myself fired. And I don't know, maybe that would have, I mean, served some purpose, but I didn't. I mean, I took the job knowing what I had to do, and I quit the job deciding that I couldn't do it anymore. But the clerk in Kentucky, she didn't do that. Now, I guess you could be cynical and say, yeah, well, Randy, were you making 80 grand, you know, when you quit 10 years ago? and so, you know, that's a lot of money in Kentucky. It's a lot of money in Missouri. But not being cynical and saying, yeah, she needs the money. You know, let's just say that she has a larger agenda than just not violating her conscience, you know, because she could easily get out from under this just by getting a new job.
Right.
And she chose not to do that. I mean, do you wonder, you know, what the next step is? There you think you have to need a purpose for this to be ongoing, you know, because for contempt, you stay in jail as long as there's any point to your contempt. So if the legislature were to meet and were to impeach her, the judge would have to let her out.
Yeah.
Is my understanding, because she no longer can be, well, she can be no longer be required to issue marriage licenses. On the other hand, if the legislature were to meet and either draft some sort of conscience clause, you know, that she personally wouldn't have to do this, mm-hmm. or if the legislature were to do something really radical, like get the government out of the marriage license issuing business, she might, you know, escape it that way. Although probably not completely, because it seems to me that the way these things are being done, the county recorder, even if you did not issue marriage licenses, you know, they didn't issue marriage licenses. I don't know about every other state. I know in my state, they didn't issue marriage licenses back in the 19th century. The early laws regarding marriage, they had some laws because it was a crime for a black person to marry a white person. I mean, that was one marriage law that the state of Missouri had from the beginning, that was a crime. But you didn't need any kind of a license. You didn't need any permission in advance to marry anybody. Mm-hmm. Although they did make a provision from the very beginning that you could take your marriage contract or whatever certificate maybe you got from the preacher or something, and you could register that. I think you were maybe even supposed to register it with the county clerk or the county recorder.
Yeah.
And so that kind of, I guess that was, if you had that situation, it would still put the person in, the recorder would think that was a conflict. I don't know. There is a difference, I suppose, between me as a government official giving you permission to get married, as opposed to me taking a piece of paper and saying, yeah, I'll put it in our record book, right?
Yeah.
Well, and we will be back
right after this trip to the market.
After we go to the market.
You and the hamster in your brain are listening to Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean and his weird friends.
The Central Scrutinizer is a Soviet-style Leviathan trying to keep track of all you do. That's why I use a VPN, or virtual private network, from Bola VPN. Bola VPN is inexpensive, secure, and will allow you to use your computer without leaving a trail. Bola VPN is now also offering torrent seed boxes for safely sharing media with the world. And if you open a support ticket saying you heard about them from the Freedom Fiends, they'll add 3 extra days free. That's Bola VPN at BOLEHVPN.net.
So off air there, I was asking, we should point this out. We have new listeners that are coming and going, and we're on the radio. Randy England in Missouri. I'm down in Alabama, and Randy is a practicing attorney. So we're not just a couple guys spouting off the top of our heads. I'm a guy spouting off the top of my head, but Randy actually knows what he's talking about. So I presented Randy with this question during the break that, and I don't have any inside information, so I'm not making an accusation against this lady in Kentucky, but in a situation like this, Randy, what would happen if a person speaking, you know, with the advice of an attorney and said, look, I want to make this a First Amendment issue. I'm a government employee. Let's say just, you know, by chance she is a member in good standing of an established religion like Baptist or Catholic that have a very well-stated position on same-sex marriage. What are the odds that she would be able to say, you know, like I said, under the advice of attorney, I think I'm going to make a First Amendment stand on this, either for my own moral purposes, or maybe even hopefully I'll get fired and I'll have a case against the state or against the federal government that I can bring in a First Amendment lawsuit and fill my pockets. Is there any chance that something like that might be a plausible plan of attack?
Well, you know, first of all, I'm not so sure that I'm an expert on the subject either. I'm a criminal defense attorney, and that's you know, not the same as being a, you know, free speech First Amendment sort of person and that sort of thing. You know, it seems though that there would be a, you know, there's kind of a problem. I don't know how big a part of her job is to, you know, issue marriage licenses. And so I don't know if the essence of her job is to do this thing. It would seem to be kind of absurd. Say you had a fellow whose job was an executioner, and he decided at some point, maybe he had a conversion and decided that he could no longer in good conscience, for religious reasons, say, he could no longer in good conscience execute people, but he expected to keep his job and be paid for being the, you know, the state executioner. I mean, everybody would look at that and think, well, that's kind of ridiculous. I mean, aside from the morality of your job and whether you or anyone should do it, you could hardly expect to continue earning a salary for a job whose essence, very core responsibility, you could not do. And that would be kind of interesting. There are, around the country, we're seeing some more stories of not just county clerks issuing license, but you're hearing about some judges that are refusing to do weddings. And typically what you're seeing is this same thing, not refusing to do same-sex marriages, but refusing to do all marriages, although it seems to be admittedly because they saw the handwriting on the wall and said, well, if I'm going to have to get into the business of officiating at same-sex marriages, I'm just not going to get into that business at all. They'd be kind of like a baker who says, I'm no longer going to bake any cakes.
Right.
You know, not just the cakes for weddings I don't like. And with a, as I understand it, in many places, and it may be that way in my state, judges, their central duties do not involve weddings. There's a difference between a statute authorizing you to do something and a statute making it your making it one of your duties.
Right.
And I think in many places judges do not have a duty to do weddings. They have power to do them if they choose. Just like a minister. I can't imagine that. I think that a religious minister in every state in the union is probably empowered to do weddings, but none of them are ever have to do them. And it may be that situation with judges, but with a person whose job is literally to issue marriage licenses, I mean, if you're the person who works at the driver's license bureau and you decide you can't in good conscience hand out driver's licenses, I mean, what's your point? You know, what's the point of you being here drawing a paycheck? So that's kind of an issue that, you know, I don't know how central this is to her job, but apparently it is her duty to issue marriage licenses. We'll come back.
Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean. This is what radio sounds like now.
When you shop online, please do it through the Freedom Fiends Amazon link over on the right side of freedomfiends.com. It won't cost you any extra, and the Fiends will get a little taste from Amazon, and Amazon will save you the danger of drive-by stabbings at your local mall. Amazon sells pretty much everything you can buy on this earth, except for guns and weed. But they do sell the DVD Guns and Weed, The Road to Freedom. So get that for your gun-hating stoner brother or neocon gun nut dad. They'll thank you for it. That's freedomfiends.com. Freedom, Foxtrot, Echo, Echo, November, Sierra.com.
Back on the Freedom Fiends. So during the break, again, we were talking about this further. You had mentioned some of the reactions that we're seeing from around in what might be considered the libertarian community or the liberty community or whatever. That is, it's kind of odd to see the reactions that we're seeing, because you have this clerk who is literally standing up to a judge and saying to the judge, you're not the boss of me. You can't make me do what I don't want to do. And normally you would think libertarians would cheer for something like that.
Oh, yeah. That would be the ultimate of libertarian flash, you know, before we can get to a stateless society where so-and-so goes into court and tells the judge that, judge, you could kiss my behind. And you know, the libertarians would just jump up across the whole nation cheering. And to be fair, though, there are some libertarians that have noticed this and say that. I think there was even an article maybe just real recent, like, came out, you know, and said, hey, this clerk, look what she's done. You know, she stood up and that sort of thing. But I've been on a number of Facebook pages and that where I have people that I know, even friends, you know, libertarians who are really, for some reason, they hate this woman so much. And she's so easy, you know, to hate from some standpoints. I mean, here's this. First of all, she's a Southerner, okay? Now, Southerners, and she's further Southern than even me. So she sounds, you know, according to the stereotype, she sounds even dumber and more bigoted than I do. Because she's from the South.
Right.
That's and a strike so against she's, her. It's the stereotypical thing. She's from the South, you know, so is Jerry Falwell. And so there's a huge swath of people who just despise everything anyone who looks or smells like this is. And she's a picture of that.
Yeah.
And so I don't know if they hate her so much or they're so delighted to see one of these fundamentalist Christians get their comeuppance, that when they see her in a jail cell, they're just jumping for joy, and someone isn't grabbing them and say, hey, man, you're a libertarian, and this woman's in jail because she told a judge to kiss her behind. And it's like they would be going, oh, my gosh, you're right. You're right. I would normally be cheering her from the housetops, no matter how ridiculous her position was, and yet they're not with her, so that's not all, but I have certainly seen some people I was surprised to see that. And then when you get on and maybe, you know, type a response like, I don't know, I mean, I'm never comfortable with anybody being thrown in jail for civil disobedience,
right?
And yet that's where she is. It also gives you, I'm thinking the people that have this glee about her being in jail that are supposed to be libertarians, I hope that they're just overcome by emotion, you know, when they give her so much trouble about this. I hope it's not actually kind of an insight into how deep their libertarianism goes.
Yeah.
Because if you can't keep your, you know, tolerance, you know, I mean, tolerance. And when I say tolerating people, I mean tolerating what they do without going and harming them. I don't mean approving of whatever they do. I understand why people don't approve of this lady and what she does, and I understand why I may not approve of what you do, you know, and that's fine. But if I'm not coming over there to toss you in jail or fine you for what you think or do, then that's, you have that much right to expect me to leave you alone. And when they're so delighted that a person like her, who has not only not been left alone, but has actually been thrown in jail,
right?
I wonder, you know, how deep their libertarianism is, because the test of any libertarian is not how well you tolerate your friends, but how well you tolerate your enemies.
Exactly.
You know, it's the same thing about, you know, freedom of speech. I mean, everybody's good with free speech when the speech is music to their ears. And it's only when you hate it that you become actually an advocate of free speech when you still stand up for it, or at least don't try to stop it.
You know,
so I'm kind of interested, you know, in that reaction of people.
How many times have we heard libertarians say, and I know I've said it, that I may not agree with you, but I'll fight for your right to say it. And that's essentially what we've got here. I don't have to agree with this woman. I don't have to look at her as anything other than, you know, a bigot or a religious radical, or I can look at her any way I want. But I still, as a libertarian, I should be willing to defend her right to say anything, even if I believe it to be utterly ridiculous.
Well, that's true. Now, I'd have to go case by case before I would promise to defend you're right. It's cheap to defend you on the radio. I realize that. Less cheap that, you know, in between the breaks in the show, Ben, you know, so far you and I haven't conspired to actually get our guns and go to break her out yet.
Right.
So, you know, there's levels of defense, I suppose. And I draw the line, you know, that line that says, every time I hear that line, I guess I laugh about, you know, I may not like what you say, but I'll defend. No, and you didn't say this. I'll defend to the death.
Right.
You know, and every time I hear it, I just kind of back up and go, well, I don't know about the death part and everything. Maybe that's, you know, it's kind of, maybe it's overkill. I'm not sure. But I don't know. We'll see how the thing comes out. I think the governor in Kentucky had the power to call a special session of the legislature so that some fix might be made.
Mm-hmm.
But he said, nah, there's no hurry to do that. We can just wait till the regular session starts, what, in January maybe? And I wouldn't be surprised if they did do something, but she may just, no telling, she could sit in jail. Remember the lady who refused to testify in the Whitewater case? Who was that? Friend of the Clintons.
Yeah.
Her name was Susan somebody or other. She was in jail for a long time. I remember they had a special show about her when she'd been in there for a year.
Yeah.
Because she refused to testify. And I don't know when she finally got out. I'm sure that she did. But the court can keep you there as long as the situation that put you there continues to exist. So if you are thrown in jail for contempt of court for refusing to testify at a trial, well, then they can hold you there until the trial is over anyway.
Yeah.
And if it's a situation where you're still the clerk who has a duty to issue marriage licenses, the judge can hold you there as long as the duty still exists and you still refuse to issue the licenses. So she could be there until her term is up.
When a person is
Or she could be a...
Oh, go ahead and finish your thought there.
Yeah. No, I'm finished. Go ahead.
I was going to ask, and this is more procedurally, I suppose, than anything else, but when a person is in court, what is the... I know the line is a bit fuzzy, and it's a little bit arbitrary, but what exactly is the line where a judge can say, all right, you are in contempt of this court, and I'm going to hold you, you know, 24 hours or 48 hours, or I'm going to hold you until you cooperate with the court or apologize to the court, or how does that generally work?
Well, I think you can have it go a couple of ways. One is if you do something that is contemptuous, shall we say, in the courtroom, in the sense that if you do something that is disrespectful to the judge, if you jumped up and started screaming at the judge, or if you jumped up and rushed at the bench like you were going to attack the judge could immediately punish you for your contempt of court. And that can be, as I understand it, I'm not an expert on this thing, but I've seen it a couple of times, they can actually just hit you with a punishment. Like if a lawyer gets out of line, the judge can in many places just simply fine them. Like, I punish you X, that's it. Now we'll move on, don't do it again. Or the judge could take you and throw you in jail, you know, till the next day in court, and then you come back in and don't do it again. But that's one kind of contempt where it's something that's disrespectful to the court or interrupting to the court right in the court's face. This is a different thing. The lady has, as far as I can tell, has not been in any way disrespectful to the court or disruptive to the court, where she would simply be punished for something she's done. What she's done is that the court ordered her to do something that the court at least thinks it has the right to order, and she said, I won't do that, or I can't do that. And that's the kind of contempt that can go on theoretically forever. But it can go on. It can go on definitely for an indeterminate amount of time. And in this situation, it could very well go on until the end of her term. And perhaps if she got reelected, she could stay there for another 4 years. I don't know.
Do you think it'll come into the discussion, the fact that the law has actually changed since she has been in office? Because as I understand it, you know, it didn't used to be like this. They didn't have to give same-sex marriages, and then the law changed, and then they had to. So would she be able to use that to say, you know, when I took this job, I didn't have to, and you guys changed the conditions of it, and I'm still wanting to hold back with the old conditions? Is that, would that be a factor in a case like this?
Well, I don't know. You know, you would think that that would be to have a deal where you were, if you signed a contract to do a certain thing and then one side changed it, you would think that that would give you the right to leave and not have to do it. I don't know. And this is a person who's in office. All county office holders can expect that during their terms of office, the legislature will change the law, or the courts in this case, would change some law that says, well, starting in January of this coming year, you'll have to start collecting an extra nickel for every, you know, property that you title, or an extra dollar, or whatever it is. And I don't think they have any grounds to complain. I think their job is just simply to collect the extra nickel when, you know, the legislature has changed the law or stopped collecting the nickel, if they reduced a fee or something. I don't know how that would work. But still, that doesn't address the issue of the fact that as an office holder in the United States, you have the right to resign at any time you want.
True. Yeah.
So that's why I think there's more going on here than just her protecting her conscience.
You're listening to The Freedom Fiends, an invigorating alternative to those other shows.
Are you tired of your taxes funding endless occupations around the world? Antiwar.com is run by people who understand that wars abroad become wars at home, wars on our freedoms. Antiwar.com is dedicated to bringing you the latest in news, views, interviews, and reviews from the top movers and shakers in the anti-occupation movement. Antiwar.com has it all, from thorough foreign policy analysis to interviews with whistleblowers who used to run the military-industrial complex. Antiwar, pro-free market. That's Antiwar.com.
Wrapping up the first hour, and we've been talking about this case in Kentucky where the county employee has refused to do same-sex marriage, and well, she's refused to do any marriages, and that has caused the problem there. And we mentioned a little bit earlier that I think part of the hate that's being thrown at her is because she is maybe the perfect person to hate. She is not a supermodel in, you know, in her looks. She has, maybe she takes on the appearance of a religious fanatic. She has a Southern accent. She's from, you know, an evil Southern state in Kentucky. It's not the Deep South, like down here where I am, but to Northerners and to folks out West, Kentucky is considered part of the South. So, you know, all these things are reasons. And when she speaks, she's going to have enough of a Kentucky accent that, you know, people from maybe New York or other places are going to look down their nose at her. She makes a really good a good person to hate like that, very convenient to hate her. And I think that's probably part of it. I was going to tease, though, for the next hour that's coming up on the Freedom Fiends, we're going to be talking a little bit about a guy who also has a Southern accent, but he's sort of the antithesis of having the kind of Southern accent that maybe most people think about. John Denson is an author. He's also an attorney. He's an attorney in Alabama and has a nice practice down there where he's written some law-related stuff, but he's also written on history. And he's one of my favorite history authors. And John Denson has a very gentlemanly Southern accent. And it's, for me, listening to him speak, he's got, if you go over to Mises.com, as a matter of fact, I'll put some links in today's show notes for his page at the Mises Institute. And there's a lot of recordings of him giving talks and recordings of him giving interviews and so forth. And he has that very educated, gentlemanly Southern accent that is so smooth. And it just, to me, hearing that kind of a Southern accent is very comforting and soothing. And I've heard John Denson's voice so many times that when I read one of his books, I can't help but...
You hear his voice?
I do. My reading slows down to the speed of his voice. And it's hard for me to read his stuff and not fall asleep if I'm already tired, because it's so soothing to hear his voice. And you know, I slow my reading down to the point of where it kind of gets a little boring to me. Not that his writing is boring. It's not at all boring. But, you know, it slows down to the point in my mind of where I start to lose track of it. But I really do appreciate his
work. If anyone wants a sample of listening to John Denson, there are many of them at, mostly lourockwell.com. That he's interviewed him or put up copies of his talks. Yeah, the guy, you know, like you said, is this educated Southern accent, smooth as honey. I mean, this fella is so smooth. He makes Atticus Finch sound like a hick, right?
That's a good
That's
comparison.
Pretty good, you know?
That is a good comparison. I think if I was in Alabama and I needed an attorney, I would go to John Denson, too.
There you go. Yeah, I definitely would have to. But his what he's known for, of course, in libertarian circles, for the most part, are his talks and writings on war, especially from, I don't know, I think the Civil War up through past World War II,
yeah,
which he's written more than one thing. I know he's written one or more books on the subject, and the necessity of, I guess, what you would call revisionism,
mm-hmm.
which I don't know if that's a... He uses the word revisionism. I don't know if that's a good word to use or not, because for that to not sound sort of propagandistic by itself,
right,
you have to come at it with the presumption that the original history that was written was in itself corrupt. And in fact, John Denson's big thing is explaining to us what is really wrong with the history that we learned in school.
Yeah.
And how the wars that, which were almost uniformly wonderful, glorious things that were part of the manifest destiny of the United States of America, turn out to be very dirty and corrupt things that were founded completely on deceit.
Yeah.
And ended up with killing people all over the world, just mainly to make other people rich.
Yeah.
And we'll talk about it when we come back in the second hour. Sound good, Ben?
Yeah, let's do that.
We'll be back with the Freedom Fiends.
Are you sick of government lackeys who say, "You didn't build that"? Are you tired of elitists like Barack Obama and Al Gore taking credit for the web while trying to take over the web? Are you disgusted by experts whose concept of the internet is that it's a series of tubes? Take back the free market of computing by encouraging software developers to adopt the BIPCOT NoGov license. The BIPCOT NoGov license allows any use or modification except by governments. Go to BIPCOT.org. That's Bravo, India, Papa, Charlie, Oscar, Tango.org.
Are you tired of governments murdering people around the world? Stop using their money. There is an alternative. Bitcoin is a stateless free market non-political currency. Bitcoin cannot be inflated or controlled by any government. By using their money, you are helping the state. Stop doing it. You have an incredible alternative available now. Learn it, use it, spread it. Get started with Bitcoin at bitcoin.com. That's bitcoin.com.
This is the Freedom Fiends, a symposium of unsupervised sounds that caress your freedom fiend bone. I'm Randy Anglin and co-host Ben Stone is with me today. Ben has hacked in to the CIA's subspace mind control to beam our pirate signal of protest directly to your frontal lobes. So lose the tinfoil hats and know that you are free. Hey, Ben, how are you in this second hour of the Freedom Fiends?
Hey, Randy. Good to talk to you.
Good to see you. And I should also mention the Freedom Fiends is covered all over by a BIPCOT no government license, which allows reuse by anyone except governments. So learn more about that at BIPCOT.org. So, Ben, we left the first hour, and I think we had just started to talk about the honey-voiced Southern lawyer John Denson and his writings. Mostly, they have the purpose of explaining why all of the history about the wars that we learned in school were maybe not 100% right. And I think you mentioned that he had a couple recent interviews on Lou Rockwell, and that kind of was an introduction to Mr. Denson. So let me give it to you for a minute or two here. Huh?
Yeah, he's always been one of my favorites. I've known about John Denson for probably 15 years, something like that. And I have strongly appreciated his work. One of his books, A Century of War, Lincoln, Wilson, and Roosevelt, is one of the, I live full time in an RV. My wife and I travel around the country. We move around, go campground to campground, and just enjoy the countryside. And so I have very few, I have an extensive library at home, but I carry very few books with me. But that is one of the books I keep with me. It's a small book, but it is a good book that I keep with me specifically if I want to reference something from that time frame or the wars, or if I want to talk to somebody and show them something, if I'm, you know, communicating with another RVer, another camper or whatever, and I want to demonstrate to them what it is I'm talking about. A Century of War, Lincoln, Wilson, and Roosevelt by John Denson is an excellent book to just have with you. It's got everything you need in it to get a very clear idea of how many kinds of lies have been told to school children in America over the last 150 years or so. And then he's got other...
You know,
go ahead.
Well, I was just going to mention, I think that book, A Century of War, is available free in PDF or in EPUB, ebook format, at lewrockwell.com.
Oh, that's... I'll look for a link for that.
So you...
Yeah.
You can read it right on your Kindle or your Nook or your tablet, and that would be an easy cheap way to get a copy of it.
Yeah.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. I interrupted.
It's definitely worth having. I'll find a link for that and put it in today's show notes. Yeah, so he's one of my favorite speakers also just to listen to, because we were talking about his just buttery sounding voice that he's got is so wonderful. And there's quite a few lectures that he has done, or talks, I should say, at the Mises Institute that are available over there. And you can download those and listen to them. And there's some of them that are published on YouTube as well, so you can actually listen in there. But one way or the other, his stuff is really important. And I wanted to get that out to tell people, if you are not familiar with this guy, you really ought to give a listen to his stuff, or at least, you know, take a look at the book, or any of his other writings. He's got articles as well at Lou Rockwell that are very good articles. But the one thing I think that his major point is to try to get people to rethink what they've been told about the origins of wars, and specifically the wars that have had such a huge impact on American history, like Lincoln's War and the two world wars, Now, Randy, you said something before we started that really struck home with me. You had mentioned that in school, you're pretty much told or taught that all wars are justified and all wars are good, and somehow there's, you know, the heroes are saving the day. That's always the storyline of the wars. But then when you were very young, delivering newspapers, there was a war going on that you could follow firsthand. You didn't have to be lied to by the schools about that. And that's kind of my experience too. I'm a few years younger than Randy, but that's my experience as well. Seeing what was really going on with Vietnam in the 60s and all the way up into the 70s, it was very hard to sell that as a good war. And I kind of wonder if maybe, you know, when other wars were going on, if people in those days were not buying the sales pitch, you know, as much as we look back and think that they maybe were. What do you think about that, Randy?
Well, of course, it helps if you won the war. And Vietnam was probably the first war that they actually had to admit that they just flat out lost. Because they kind of sneaked out of Korea, pretending like we won that, but of course we didn't. There was just a cessation of the fighting. But in Vietnam, Nixon tried to kind of tiptoe away by what they called the Vietnamization of the war, where the U.S. troops left and the South Vietnamese troops kind of took over all of the fighting jobs as the United States left. But the time frame was so short. By the time Nixon pulled out all the American troops in the early 70s, it was only just, you know, a couple of years later that we watched the last American helicopters leaving from the embassy roof, and all of the thousands of Vietnamese who had helped us and been our friends all those years were clamoring to get out of the country before they were all murdered by the North Vietnamese communists that were taking Saigon at the time. And so it was so ugly at the end that there was no pretending that we'd won anything. And so that war, you know, may have been the first war that so many people, particularly after it had gotten really going good and then got to the end of it, people didn't really think of it as a good war. But before that, when I was all in school, I can't remember ever being taught that any war was not good and righteous from the American standpoint. Mm-hmm. That we number one, had to fight, and number two, our cause was just. And for the most part, the things that we did were good and honorable. And of course, that got just exploded during the Vietnam War when you had Lieutenant Rusty Calley and the massacre of totally innocent unarmed villagers in the My Lai massacre, which was very famous at that time, and I'm sure plenty of people have heard about that now. But just the deliberate killing of unarmed civilians, children, and that have absolutely nothing that you could hold against them. I don't mean, you know, 11-year-olds that might have a bomb. I mean 3-year-olds right, that are wearing diapers, and they're just murdered indiscriminately and on purpose. And the evidence of those things happening was so completely overwhelming, it couldn't be denied. There was a part of the My Lai massacre included one of the helicopter pilots, if I recall the telling of it, that said that if he saw this killing didn't stop in that, he was going to open up his machine guns on the American troops himself.
Yeah.
Who were murdering so prolifically in this village. It was just incredible. And so the idea that we always do good and never do bad just was completely exploded in Vietnam. And so by the time I went to college, I went off to college in 1970. And by then, you know, there was just none of the illusion was left about Vietnam. But once you figure out that you've been so badly lied to and that you have behaved so badly, it kind of changes things. And in the United States, I know it changed a lot during the decade of the 70s and up to the election of Ronald Reagan, America, the United States, was strangely humble between 1975 and 1981, I felt.
Yeah.
In that we had had ourselves kicked in the backside very badly, really humiliated in losing a war that we'd fought for 10 years. And it was almost, you know, that was one good thing. That was kind of a tough time economically in the country, but it was nice not to, to be at war for quite a while. And that's part of the thing that brought Ronald Reagan into office, because the idea there is that he would restore America to greatness that people like Nixon and Gerald Ford and Jimmy Carter had lost. And, of course, when Ronald Reagan took office, we had all of those American hostages still in the, you know, from the embassy in Tehran, and that was a national humiliation. And so although that seemed like a tough time in that, it was also a time when the United States wasn't quite so active with their guns around the world. I'm not sure if that was all bad.
You know, there's another thing, too.
But anyway, the idea of... Yeah.
I was going to say, there's another thing that was happening right in that time frame in the 70s when the economy was just hurting so bad. And it seems to me, because I was a teenager in that time frame, and it seemed to me that very few people connected the dots and realized that the major reason why the economy was struggling so bad during the 60s, I'm sorry, during the 70s, is because so much money had been spent between the Cold War, the Vietnam War, and the space race. These three massive layouts of cash had cost the United States just a huge amount of money. And, you know, LBJ attempted to do something about it by his shenanigans with, you know, stopping minting silver in the mid-60s. And then Nixon tried to do something about it by taking the U.S. off the gold standard and closing the gold window and putting price and wage controls on. But all those things just added to the problem. It didn't help the problem. The problem was that more money had gone out than could possibly have come in. And I just don't seem to remember people talking about that in the 70s, that was the reason for the economic collapse they were seeing.
I think you're right.
We'll be right back on the Freedom Fiends.
You're listening to Freedom Fiends. So much truth, it hurts.
Hey, this is Squiskar Squiggles from Death Clocks. And you are listening to the Freedoms Fiends on the, you know, the radios. And I guess I says worms now. So there you go.
Tired of those old Freedom Fiends buttons? Well, the Freedom Fiends have new button designs.
As always, it's only $10 for 10 buttons, and you'll get these nifty designs. Buy sheep, for sheep, on sheep.
State speech is hate speech.
Two designs for Guns and Weed, the Road to Freedom.
Three designs for Fiend Phone.
Bipcot No Gov.
A Freedom Fiends Worms button.
And ask me about my worms.
Go to freedomfiends.com and click on the link at the top that says Buttons.
And now they're bigger buttons.
They used to be 1 1/4 inch, and now they're 1 3/4 inch. Dan, they're bigger buttons.
What does freedom mean? Tune in to LRN.FM to find out. LRN.FM is the Liberty Radio Network, a collection of live talk radio and podcasts, all coming from a principled pro-liberty perspective. LRN.FM show hosts aren't left, right, or conspiracy kooks. You can tune in 24/7 to LRN.FM via your phone, computer, satellite, and more. Listen free anytime at LRN.FM. That's LRN.FM.
Freedom Fiend. So before I started ranting about the economy in the 70s, when I was young, back when you could buy gas for 50 cents a gallon. But, and that's actually true. I was in the late 70s. I actually, as a kid, I worked in a gas station. And I remember when gas went up to 65 cents a gallon, and people were just beside themselves with anger at gas being 65 cents a gallon. That's how you know you're really old, when you tell stories like that, and young kids just, their eyes glaze over at you. Yeah, yeah, I know, Grandpa.
Back when... Ben, you're a young whippersnapper. I bought gasoline in 1970 in Dallas for 17 cents a gallon. Actually, oh, I did, but you know, we don't need any of the geezer stories. Let's go ahead.
So back to John Denson, you know, again, I really want to encourage people to take a look at that book, A Century of War. He starts with the Civil War, or, you know, Lincoln's War, or the North's War of Aggression, or however you want to use terminology. And that, even that brings up something that, Randy, that you were talking about, that Denson is able to kind of address that topic of what started the war, what was the purpose of the war, and all that kind of thing.
Oh, yeah. And of course, this is so, I mean, it's so contemporary even right now, because people fuss so much about the flag. And if the flag is all about pro-slavery, then of course the Confederate stars and bars is an ultimate symbol of evil, right up with, say, the swastika. But then there's the other side that says, no, the Civil War wasn't about slavery. It was about secession, and it was about economic issues, about how the North was, you know, screwing the South, you know, down as tight as they could to get as much they could out of them because of the tariff on manufactured goods and that. And I wasn't going to get into that right now. But one thing, Denson, I mean, he writes on so much of this, and he tells a story in one of his articles. I think it was an article, or it might have been a talk, but he tells a story about, it was like in February of 1865, and so we're just barely a little over a month before the war is going to be over, and Lincoln sent a delegation to speak with another delegation from the South to talk about ending the war on some sort of terms. And they went over all kinds of issues and that sort of thing. And the one thing that Lincoln was adamant about was that the South had to rejoin the Union. That was absolutely non-negotiable. And so whether the start of the war was about secession and holding the Union together, the end of the war was everything about that. And that was his one non-negotiable. But the issue of slavery did come up in these talks, and Lincoln, you know, it went back and forth. Like, you had the Emancipation Proclamation, which they estimated that only about 200,000 slaves out of the total of there were millions of them in the South, only about 200,000 slaves had actually come in under the operation of the Emancipation Proclamation, because it only freed slaves in places where the Union was in control. And so only 200,000 had been freed, and the question was, well, okay, if we solve this thing now, what happens? And they kind of came down to that they were okay that everybody, all the millions that were still in slavery, should remain in slavery. And then there was some concern about the 200,000 and what would happen to them, and would they remain free? And kind of they got to a point where maybe, well, they would remain free, but we're concerned about what happens with 200,000 slaves, and there's nobody to take care of them. They don't have anything. And Lincoln responded into his folksy storytelling mode about how there was this Illinois farmer, and he was proud of how he never bothered to feed his hogs and didn't pay anything for food for the hogs, and thought that this story, this farmer, would apply to the freed slaves. And Lincoln said, he said, in other words, just let them root. And Lincoln didn't care at all about the slaves or slavery. He was perfectly happy to end the war with most of the slaves still enslaved. And the ones that were freed already, well, you could just let them root.
Wow.
And so it was all about getting them into the Union. And even at the very end of the war, Lincoln did not care about the slaves. And that, when I read that, I thought, I always had a good grasp for the causes of the war at the beginning, and the tariff thing was enormous because there was this 40% input in tariff on all of the manufactured goods that came in. And we're going to the market right now, but there'll be no tariff, and everyone can just come back for free.
You're listening to the Freedom Fiends, and I'm beaming these words into your cerebellum.
This show survives on donations from fiends like you. We put that money back into our show and Liberty Outreach and donate most our ad space to Liberty organizations that make a difference. We're also a teaching hospital, educating the next generation of Liberty talkers on the skills needed to keep the radio flame of truth burning into the future. Put your money where your heart is and make a donation of any amount to the Freedom Fiends. Please go to freedomfiends.com and click on the spinning coin on any post.
Randy, what were you, you were finishing off what you were thinking there about John Dennison talking about Lincoln and his statements.
Oh, yeah, and I think to finish the thought, I think we were talking about the tariff that was imposed by the United States on manufacturing goods that were brought into the country. And the problem that the South had was that this was a 40% tariff, and the South had very little manufacturing, and the North had the manufacturing, so a large tariff in the North had the effect of protecting the industry in the North. But in the South, the large tariff simply guaranteed that the Southern people that needed the equipment and that had to pay a premium of 40%, so they could either buy the overpriced stuff from the North, or they could buy the stuff that had a 40% tariff tacked onto it that was being shipped here from overseas. And when the South left the Union, they reduced the tariff down to 10%. Back then, most of the government, North and South, was funded by the tariff. And it was just kind of common understanding that a 10% tariff was a revenue tariff, one that would, whose purpose was there to fund the government. And that seems kind of tame to us now after our income tax and all that sort of thing. But the North, and anything more than 10% was considered a protective tariff. And that's exactly what it was. And one of the big economic motivators for the South to secede was to get out from under that 40% tariff. And 40% is just huge.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, that had to do back at the beginning of the war. But I was talking about this these negotiations that were happening just a month or month and a half before the war ended, and where Lincoln made it crystal clear that he still didn't care about freeing the slaves. He didn't care a bit. And another thing that was kind of funny, I don't know if it was funny, but the issue came up of what are we going to do about West Virginia, which had seceded from the state of Virginia and remained in the Union during the Civil War. And Lincoln was quite out there and in favor of West Virginia's right to secede from Virginia, but absolutely adamant that that Virginia could not secede from the Union, and the whole thing is that they had to come back. So that was kind of ironic, but and maybe I can see why Lincoln didn't care whether he had one extra state or not, as long as he had it. And the point was, however many counties there were in West Virginia, he didn't care if they were called West Virginia or Virginia. He would have them all. And he did. Well, he did for a couple months, and then things went south for him, didn't it? Okay. I shouldn't make light of it. I mean, he got killed.
I don't know. I joke around about Lincoln and Ford's Theater and that quite a bit. There's actually, I don't know if I've told you this or not, there's a road down here that is named John Wilkes Booth Street. that's not far from where I'm at right now here in Alabama. And, you know, that kind of tells the sentiment of people. But another thing to what you were talking about there, anybody who's spent very much time driving around the South, you might notice these old forts. Like here in the Mobile Bay area, there are two forts controlling the main entry into Mobile Bay. And the reason those two forts were built, and they were built prior to the Civil War, the reason they were built was specifically because Mobile was one of the main shipping ports into the South. And there was, because of this tariff, there was a great motivation for smugglers to bring shiploads in of stuff from, say, Europe or anywhere else, and not go into the main ports like in Mobile, but go off to the side somewhere, unload their ships, and then use wagons to take the stuff into the main towns like Mobile or New Orleans or Charleston or wherever. And so that's why the federal government had built this series of forts to try to control these pinch points where the smugglers were coming in and docking near the port towns and unloading their stuff without dealing with the tariff that was going to be collected when they went into the main port. Now, you can see that in Mobile Bay. There's Fort Morgan on one side of the channel, and then there's another fort on Dauphin Island right across that channel, and they were literally set up.
Fort Gaines?
Yeah. They were set up so that the cannons could crisscross and cover that whole entry to the Mobile port like that. And that was also the site of one of the really nasty battlefields. There was, I think it was something like 1,800 Confederate soldiers died in the Battle of Mobile Bay trying to get control of that area. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to ask you. You spend so much time down there now. We all hear about Fort Sumter, that the commander of Fort Sumter refused to give up the fort to the Confederacy, and they eventually fired on the fort, which caused gave Lincoln the pretense to begin the war. But did those forts there at Mobile, did they come along easily, or was there some sort of fight over them at the beginning of the war?
The Confederates came in pretty early and took them without a lot of effort. They weren't actually completed yet. They were in the process of trying to upgrade them and get them better outfitted. So the Confederates took them pretty early, and then the Union came and took them back again. And that's where the bloodiest of the fighting took place. This is where I'm not sure I can say on the radio the quote that comes from ignoring the commander's orders to ignore the torpedoes and full speed ahead comes from that Battle of Mobile Bay. Torpedoes being, back in the day, stationary explosives, what we might call today
mines.
Yeah, exactly. They had mined, the Confederacy had mined the whole entrance of the port there. Or that bottleneck in the channel between Dauphin Island and Fort Morgan. So yeah, a lot of lives lost if you take out the slavery argument, it was so much of it was just lost lives for no reason other than to keep the empire together, keep the taxes flowing. Very sad.
Yeah, and I mean I don't think there's any doubt whatsoever that the purpose of the Civil War was Lincoln's iron decision and determination that he was going to save the Union. I mean, it's probably almost the word religious isn't right, but that manifest destiny, the idea that the United States was destined to be this great power, and if you cut it in half, it would never be as great as it would be if it held it together. And there was, and was also the notion that the tariff was, which was so, it wasn't, the tariff wasn't so much necessary to for the United States to stay there, but it was such a huge boon to the people in the North. And of course Lincoln had no, his cronies were all in the North,
right?
And they were his buddies that would have really taken it on the chin if they lost the protective tariff, not only the protections from the tariff, but the extra money that was being used for everything it was being used for.
Yeah.
And all of that would have would have been lost, because you wouldn't have had the South, you know, kind of subsidizing the North, because they were the ones that were taking it on the chin, having to pay the tariff, as opposed to the North, which it didn't hurt near so much. The North didn't need this manufactured equipment because they had their own.
Yeah,
so it was a good deal for the North and a bad deal for the South.
And anybody who's traveled very much in, say, upstate New York and across maybe Ohio, and you run across the old Erie Canal systems that crisscross that whole area of upstate New York and all the way down into Ohio, that was all being paid for. All the federal funds that went into that came from that tariff. And also the Northern Railroads were expanding tremendously with government backing, and that money was being funded from the tariffs. And oddly enough, and I think it's John Denson that points this out, or it may be one of the other authors that doesn't pop in my mind right away, but I believe it was John Denson, that Lincoln's biggest financial supporters in running for the presidency were the lumber companies that were furnishing the massive amount of lumber that was being used to build the canals and the railroads themselves and the bankers that owned the railroads. That's where Lincoln's biggest funding was coming from. The timber companies in the North and the railroads and the bankers, which were all profiting tremendously from all these new technologies, railroads and canals that were being built in the North with that funding. So talk about a conflict of interest there. He had a financial interest in keeping the Union together and keeping the money flowing.
He knew where his bread was buttered. He was a railroad lawyer himself, among other things. It's hard to figure. Go ahead.
I was going to ask, you have a connection to Southern Illinois there. Have you ever been to the old Illinois State Capitol building? Lincoln, the story was, he was called Lincoln, Leaping Lincoln, because at one point in the Illinois house, he had jumped out the window, the upstairs window, rather than take a vote. Do you know about that story?
I did know about that story. We had a family story about I had a relative back in the 1850s who spent a night with Lincoln. Apparently, Lincoln showed up at a boarding house, and they didn't have any untaken rooms. But such and such a room, which had my relative staying in the room, only had one person in it. And back then, apparently, it was common to double up in a bed, you know, which we probably wouldn't do with strangers these days. But there was apparently a couple of them, and Lincoln asked, you know, which one was a Republican or a Democrat. And I think my relative qualified and so spent the night with Lincoln. But that's probably not where you were going with your story, so I'll leave off with that. Michael, never mind. go ahead. I was going to say something about what Michael would say, but I don't even want to go there. Never mind.
We won't misrepresent Michael, since he's not with us at this particular moment.
No, that's right. He's not here.
Well, stick with us, folks. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean and some of his weird friends. And yes, we're broadcasting this into space.
Wake up and smell the freedom. One of the easiest things you can do to help Liberty is to torrent Freedom Fiends episodes to help keep them drone-proof. You can set up your home computer to download and share Freedom Fiends archives over BitTorrent. You can even set up scheduling so it only shares while you're asleep or at work. Put your unused computing power to work and help keep the Freedom Fiends around well into the future. Simply go to freedomfiends.com and click on the Torrent Club link and learn how to torrent and share Freedom Fiends archives.
Freedom Fiends. Coming in the last segment here, I wanted to mention something that John Denson has talked about that's a really touching story. He is a real good historian. He knows a lot about a lot of different topics, but one of the stories that he talks about is the Christmas truce that happened in, there was actually several of them, but in World War I, they're in, you know, in France, where France and Germany and England are battling it out, and John Denson tells a story about how some of the troops in the trench warfare, they were so close to each other that you could literally hear each other talking in the distance. And Christmas time was coming around, and you know, the German troops would be singing Christmas carols, trying to raise their own spirits a little bit, and the English troops are doing the same, trying to raise their spirits a little bit. And oftentimes, there are Christmas carols that are common to both German and English languages. They just switch the words around to make them German or English, but it's the same song. So you would literally have a situation where the Germans were singing a Christmas carol that the English in their trenches knew every word of it by heart, but they knew it in English. And so you would have a situation where these guys are singing the same Christmas carols at night. And eventually this got to the point of where they came out of the trenches, they started exchanging gifts, exchanging, you know, helmets, or here's some cigarettes, or here's some, you know, some food rations or whatever. And they started playing some soccer out there in the fields and everything, and communicating. And it got to the point of where commanders really worried about whether they would be able to get these guys to go back to, you know, slaughtering each other again. If this continued, if this friendship was allowed to go. And so commanders had to forcibly make the men stop communicating with the enemies across the line. And John Denson does a really good job of telling this story. It's a really heartwarming story. And it really lets you know how human these guys were that were stuck in an unhuman situation, totally unnatural for humans to be, you know, attempting to just kill each other when you don't even know who the guy is. It's not at all part of the human condition. It's a very unnatural thing that's been put upon us by governments. And so when you get them together where they have the opportunity and they're that close together, they start to find things that are in common. And unless the, you know, unless the government goons that are in charge of all this stuff, unless they get in there and break them apart, people end up being friends. And it's really hard to kill somebody when, first off, you don't have anything, you don't have a beef with them to begin with. But then on top of that, you start being friendly with them. It takes it to the point of where commanders lose the ability to tell you to jump up and run into those machine guns because, you know, you're not going to do it. That's one of the things from John Denson that I really enjoyed hearing from him.
I think that there actually was a movie made about the Christmas truce around 2006. I don't know if it might have been French, or I'm not sure if it was in English, called Joyeux Noël or Merry Christmas. But they say that the Christmas truce, that we would not even know about the Christmas truce except for the British soldiers, because the French and the Germans that were involved in that, their countries, I guess maybe were a little more paranoid than those in the English, and all of their letters home were censored.
Wow.
And so every word about the Christmas truce and what happened never got home and never got to any of the newspapers back in Germany or in France. But in England, they apparently were not censoring, or not carefully censoring, or caring, I'm not sure which, weren't censoring these letters back home, and they ended up getting publicized. And so people found out of them only because of that. You wouldn't have gotten anything from the Germans, who were apparently a little ahead of the English at thinking over what a problem the Christmas truce really was.
So it's government's incompetence that that not only created the wars, but government's incompetence almost let the cat out of the bag and letting the information slip out. Because I'm sure they probably,
kind of incompetence. Don't you approve that sort of incompetence?
Oh, yeah. It's the saving grace. of governments.
Yes, it really is. Some of the best things they do are through negligence.
Hey, Randy, thanks for coming on the show with me.
Hey, thank you for having me, Ben. We'll have to do this again.
Yep.
And I appreciate being here with you on the Freedom Team. See ya.